Okay, good morning everyone, and thank you very much to Jane and to Donna for the kind invitation to talk this morning with you. And I apologize for all the last minute tech issues, which actually aren't a surprise. I knew something was brewing here with the cameras, but now we have a diagnostic, so we'll get it fixed soon.
It's only 5 past 10. We've done really well given the circumstances.
Okay. So, you obviously from the title of the talk, and I don't know what your backgrounds are. So, you may be familiar with chronic pain, or you may not be, but I'm going to keep this very basic. But just suffice to say, that's the area I'm extremely interested in, and I have worked in. I've been working, as Jane knows, as an autogenic trainer, as a, on a bona fide basis, primarily since 97. I started training. My first training was from 97 to 2000 on a research basis, and then I retrained with Jane's team in 2016 just to do a refresher. So I absolutely love this technique. It's a life changer. For me, it was a life changer for coping. And I find it a major ongoing stress management technique. And at the moment, I actually probably have picked up something, just been through a big injury with the shoulder, which I managed to do a big job on my shoulder, which I'm recovering well from. It's going to be a long haul job. And thank goodness for autogenic training. In a nutshell and in a sentence, what it does is reduce the stress response and also allow for homeostatic mechanisms in the whole mind and body to ameliorate, to settle down, to become kind of what we call in a good place. So it's anti-stress, but more than anti-stress, it also helps with symptom burden. And for people with chronic pain, because in my initial starting off, I worked with people with cancer. And obviously, cancer now is classified as chronic pain of non-malignant origin because many cancer conditions now are long-term, but they don't necessarily have a cure. So people are living with symptoms for years and years and years, which require management. So techniques for them that they find useful are vital alongside pain management. So I want to say that to you, this is not alternative, it is complementary. It's complementary along with medication. So we work very closely with the medical profession, and that is very important. It really is important because it's a huge educational piece. And you probably know about this association, the International Association for Study of Pain. And I would really strongly recommend that you go on this website as soon as you have a few minutes and just browse around. And if you can, think about becoming a member at even the starter level where it's not very expensive, but the benefits of membership of IAS are really tremendous from an educational perspective, from a collegial perspective, from a personal professional development perspective. And if you're interested and you have a thing about professional development out there and service development, especially, which is the thing that really gets me buzzing, getting services developed for people with pain. That is the place to get collegial links. So I asked in recent times updated their definition of pain. And they have a new definition, an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with or resembling that associated with potential tissue damage. I know we've got a little bit of a block here. I'm just going to just. With actual or potential tissue damage. And that you just note on that. What does that mean? It means is it's always personal. That's a key thing. Remember that. Pain is always personal. It's influenced by varying degrees of our own biology, our psychology, both current and past, and the social context we live in now and what we experienced in the past. That is why we have to believe the patient. We cannot make a judgment for them. What the patient says their pain experience is the valid thing. Pain and nociception are different. Pain cannot be inferred solely from activity, which is going on in the psychobiological system. So we have to know the pain is the subjective, and nociception is what's going on in the system. People learn throughout their lives about the experiences they've had and what how to be careful with it. It's supposed to be a survival mechanism, but of course sometimes it goes wrong because we have now mechanisms, we're living much longer, we have mechanisms that exaggerate our perceptions, and things go wrong in our bodies to exaggerate our experiences. But the crucial thing is that we respect the person's report of pain. That is absolutely crucial. And that's our starting point, as if we work with people with pain, we respect the person. We don't tell them, oh, it's not that, or you're exaggerating, or you're making it up. We respect what they are telling us. That's our starting place. And pain stops us in our tracks. It may have an adverse effect on our function in every way, our work, our social function, our psychological well-being. And sometimes there's actually no words. But we're lucky because we can speak. But imagine if you're in a lot of pain and you cannot speak. Then you're in really, really dire situation because you haven't anyone. Well, now with technology, it's a slightly different scenario. But when you cannot tell somebody else what you're going through and get help for what your experience is, that is not a nice place to be, as you can imagine. So there's the definition. And the whole point about the changing, because IAS has gone through different variations, different definitions of pain over the years since it was founded in the 70s. But the new definition was relying on someone's ability to describe their experience. And it said an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with the actual or potential damage or described in terms of such damage. But it excluded infants because they couldn't obviously express their pain verbally. Elderly people who often are, and this is where my passion is that pain doesn't actually diminish with age. It does not, like that, it doesn't. And people who are older have a big battle on their hands getting believed. And even animals as well, who cannot verbally articulate their pain. So now we go by what the person says, and that has to be experienced. So we go to the next slide, Jane. Thank you. So I want to really say to you, I'm sending you some resources. Really, really go there, guys, and have a look at what these resources are. They are vast. IASP has done fantastic work on this website in recent times. Absolutely fantastic. And there's also a pain education resource center called PERK. And you can do, if you've got a healthcare background, you can do mini courses and get credits for your CPD. And I'm always looking for ways of getting my CPD points. So it's always really useful to be, okay, I can update. And you don't have to do something major, you can do something minor. But adding to your knowledge base all the time and you're updating your knowledge base, the resources for updating your pain education on IASP are phenomenal now. They really are excellent. Okay, so go to the next one. Thanks. So what are we talking about psychological? Obviously, from a perspective of looking at autogenic training, we are obviously working with the psychosocial aspects, particularly from autogenic training. We are giving people empowerment from a psychosocial perspective. And what are those approaches that have been so helpful for people? Well, hypnosis, we know about, that's when people hand over the control often of themselves to somebody else to induce a certain state. Relaxation interventions, which are extremely valuable still because we can combine various techniques. Mindfulness meditation, where we can focus on where we are in the moment. Operant treatment for curing, helping people work through difficult problems, difficult behaviors where they have what we say, self-defeating behaviors, where they can help learn and have some insight into their behavior and how to stop that and go into something more positive. And then we have the graded exposure in vivo, which I've never got down to because you wouldn't put me in a room with a few spiders. I can tell you I'm not a good person for that. Motivational interviewing, cognitive behavioral therapy, we know all about these and acceptance behavioral therapy. But what happens with people with pain? Well, you often find, and you have to be really careful and a little bit philosophical on this. And I'm just saying my view on this because it does vary across practitioners. When you have someone who has got severe chronic pain and they've managed it for years, they get very good at their self-management. They get to know the system really well because that's what we do. We empower them to get to know the system very well. And they know what works for them. And sometimes they have to stay within certain pathways of treatment because if they opt out, they can't get back into those pathways, especially in Ireland. You have to be really, really careful. If somebody's actually on a care pathways for somewhere, you don't stop that suddenly because they'll have a really difficult time picking that up again. So you've got to watch whether you can match 80 with something else. So I know it's a contentious area. I know in a purist world, you do 80 and nothing else. That's for research purposes, particularly because you've got to see the pre and post. You've got to see the true effect. But if you're talking about management on a day-to-day basis of chronic pain, then people are not in a purist world. They cannot control the variables. They're trying to get by on a day-to-day basis. And you do what they can do. And they are the ones in charge. And that's the real key to chronic pain. You give the person with pain control. And that's what AT does. It's absolutely fantastic for helping people have a sense of control back because, believe you me, pain takes that sense of control away. Okay, next slide, please, Jane. So as you can see, every psychosocial intervention only addresses a subset of all the psychosocial factors hypothesized to play a role in how we all function. Because we've all, I don't expect there's anybody there today who has never been a patient. I would be very surprised if none of us ever been a patient. We're always sometimes a patient. I know often we are clinicians or we are therapists or whatever we are. So we know what it is to be a patient. A patient is a person receiving a medical service of some type and going through a treatment program. So we have to be aware of what our benefits and limitations are. And that's key as well. We have to have a little bit of humility about what we're capable of doing. We don't have the answer to everything. AT is fantastic, but it's not everyone's panacea. It's not everyone's cup of tea. If it suits, it can be phenomenal. It can be a life changer. It can be really, really powerful. But you have to be respectful about whether somebody decides, oh, you know what, I got more out of doing my peers, or I got more out of doing my CBT programs, or I don't find that. Well, you respect that, but we can't press people to buying something. If they don't like it, they don't like it. Often it's a time thing. Often it's a, okay, inhibition thing, or they haven't really bought into for all sorts of reasons. But I find if you give people time and if you give them very positive, encouraged feedback and explanations that are simple about what's happening, because what people are now is they're much more educated than they used to be. All we have to go, every one of us, all we have to do is go on our phone. We've got our iPhones or we've got our Androids in front of us. We just dial in a word. And there we have a paragraph of explanation. We can learn anything we like. And that's what patients are doing. That's why they're coming to the surgery. They're going to their outpatient clinics and they're armed with a mountain of information that 20 years ago people would never have had. So they're very, very informed and they know what they like and they learn very quickly what works for them. So clinicians need to be aware of the benefits and limitations, because the patients are often 10 jumps ahead of the clinicians. So we need to know what's the framework, the psychosocial components, the effect of those components, and how they impact on pain treatments. Are they going to impact on pain treatments? And what are the similarities and differences? We need to know what the limitations of what we do are and how it's going to work and when it's going to work. So just that comes with practice And that comes with being open to listening to other people's opinions and experiences and recognizing that we are all different. People have different experiences. Okay, next slide, Jade. Thank you. Okay, so psychosocial, five psychosocial factors. Our environment plays a massive role. Do we have an environment that allows us time for self-care? And especially if you have chronic pain, you need that time. You need a time where you can relax without threat. That can be really, really difficult. Believe you me, it can be really difficult to find an environment without threat, especially if you're an older person. I, as you know, spent some years as a senior health promotion officer with the health service for older persons in South Dublin. And believe you me, the level of elder abuse that would happen is you wouldn't credit that people could be so nasty, but they can be because there is a mindset out there of bullying. And if they see you're vulnerable, and if they think they're getting a rise, as they call a rise out of you know, they're getting a reaction, that gives them a buzz. I mean, pathetic and all as it is, that's what happens. They get a buzz out. They like doing it. However small and how mean and nasty it is, they'll do it. So that's terribly important. People need that environment where they can go and put in downtime. Right now we know what to do. We put in our earplugs. We've got our Bose Sleep 2. We've got our Pelter Optimate 3 headsets. And we can plug in those things. We can plug in our iPhones. We can plug in whatever and listen to our music to block out stupid. But believe you me, stupid goes on. So that's an environmental factor for one example. Brain state factors, anxiety particularly, cognitive content, coping and behaviors. People are better at coping generally because they've had to get good during coping. During COVID, sorry. During COVID, a lot of people acquired skills which they wouldn't have had before. But there's an antithesis of that is that things happened in their environment that made life difficult. You would have heard bad press about Ireland recently, where we have become the cocaine capital of Europe. Yeah, oh, aren't we wonderful? Cocaine capital of Europe. Now, so you go down into up to recently because it's all suddenly changing now because we have got a major input of policing to counteract this and a major drive by the public to say, go away, stupid. Because we're not tolerating that anymore. But because the shops were shut and because people didn't go into town, it became a haven for drug addicts, and particularly cocaine. So we put on a major, major push, all of us, and said, we're not tolerating this. And that is why it's about having social support for the things that happen in our environment to help us. We're not tolerating it. We're just not tolerating it. We're all getting law diplomas and legal consults and reporting adverse behavior. So hypnosis, relaxation training, mindfulness meditation, all focus on brain state because that's where we have to go to have that rest, that downtime that is so important for us to maintain our health. And that intervention is targeting beliefs that we can do something about what we're going through. It is empowering and it helps us feel, okay, there's light at the end of the tunnel. Instead of feeling, oh my gosh, you know, I'm done, I'm dead, I'm doomed. And that's what we have to watch. We have to give people the skills to feel, okay, it's going to be all right. Okay. Next sheet, please. Okay, so here you can see just in a quick diagram, the cognitive content, the coping particularly, and the behavior, how the two are linked. And the things that influence that, the brain state particularly, where are we in our mind? How are we adjusted to the pain? The pain severity, and I'm going to come to that next, psychological functioning, how are we doing that? And physical functioning, how are we doing with that? Now you can hear from me, I'm one big fighter, okay? I'm one big fighter. I in my apartment here now I have a little bookcase, and on the top shelf are 10 copies of Night Fighter. Jimmy Ronski, the most decorated fighter pilot in the world, was friendly with my parents, and his wife taught me how to ride a pony. I was on the back of a Connemara pony at the age of two. I learned how to fight very, very young. And I have just that skill. I'm a really difficult person. And if there's things I don't like, I'll go out and I'll change them as much as I can. I will make a fuss to change things I don't like. And anybody who knows me well knows that's what I do. And I don't care what people think. And I had a lot of flack about that, I can tell you, a lot of flack. But I do it. And believe you me, it's the way I am. I fight my corner. And more it's recognized that that's what the key to pain management on a personal basis is. You fight your corner. And that's why patients now are so well informed, because they know that knowledge is power. They know that knowledge is power. So we have all over Europe now, we have organizations that are led by patients for patients. In Ireland, we have a really good organization, Chronic Pain Ireland. And I want to just ask you to write down that website, Chronic Pain Ireland, because I didn't actually put a slide in about that, and I should have done, because on Chronic Pain Ireland website, there's a whole lot of videos about management of chronic pain in different contexts of chronic pain. And I've got a video up there myself. When COVID happened and we couldn't come in to give our interventions, autogenic training interventions, which I've been giving for years there, we were invited by the national coordinator for Chronic Pain Ireland to make a video. And Baz was really helpful. The then chair, Judith Wren, helped me with the tech team, and we constructed the video and it went up on the website. And it really, really helps people to get through those difficult times. So you can see that what people need is information. They need to know how to. They need to know where to go to get help. And if they have got support from similar others who have been through what they're going through, it is nothing less than invaluable. Okay, the next slide, please, Jade. Okay, so this is a really important slide, folks. You will, through Jane and through Donna, you will know that autogenic training very much impacts the autonomic nervous system, sympathetic nervous system, and the parasympathetic nervous system to help, as well as the entire system within the mind and body to promote homeostasis. Now, some of us have a very labile autonomic nervous system. You will probably have heard of that for people who are divers. You would have heard of parasympathetic rebound, maybe, when people go diving and then they suddenly get this massive parasympathetic rebound where they go into a major relaxation response. Well, some of us have that type of system where our system lets us down very easily. And for all the world to see, it looks as though we're drunk. And that is so difficult. I've had it lifelong. And I've had to cope with it lifelong, because I can tell you, people don't understand it now. You may have had a talk by your colleague, Dr. Rousseau, who specializes in this whole area as well. Oh, excuse me. I'm so sorry. I had it as a kid. I had it as a teenager. I had it as a nurse. And I had it all my life. And for some people, it can be very labile. And that's why I'm doubly careful for people with pain. You need to take this on board. If you take one message on board, it's about patient safety. You have to watch what people say and listen. Because for us with pain, our blood pressure goes walkabout. I mean, walkabout. And we have to check our own blood pressure. We're asked to and we're taught to check our own blood pressure regularly. And we work with our GPs to make sure that our blood pressure is kept within a safe range, because we have to take medication periodically, which has to be monitored, and that has to be altered according to our need. But the point about it is that we're trying to avoid stroke. Because if your blood pressure goes up into a certain realm, as you know, you are at risk of stroke. And that's what we're fighting all the time, is to keep that blood pressure down, to stop it. But we have to catch it early. We have to inform our GP if it starts going up. So we have that we adopt a lifestyle that helps us keep our blood pressure under control. So with people with pain, the chances of stroke are increased. And especially if there is an acute scenario of pain that's compounding the chronic pain, the chances of stroke are very much increased. The GP wants to know where the blood pressure is. The patient needs to know where their blood pressure is so that they can avoid keep the stroke risk as low as possible. But that's monitored very carefully. Okay, so I'm talking about daily check on their blood pressure at least. Daily check at least. Okay. So and we have to tell the GP if there's any problems. The other negative part of having that problem, this labile autonomic nervous system, is that you can faint very easily. And I do faint easily. And again, that's where people think, perhaps you have too many problems. So I can tell you, it's what is it now? September, the last alcohol I had was a year ago, July, with my family on an afternoon tea with Dublin, up a year ago at July. So it's really difficult to get people to believe that part of your life. You can drink tea and coffee and all that stuff, and this can still happen. So watch that particularly. You can say to people, oh, okay, AT is safe for you, but you have to work in conjunction with their blood pressure. So we always, now this brings me into the next part. That is why I have never trained ever a person with cancer or pain without having GP permission. In fact, all my 30 odd years of doing AT with people, every single training I've had has had to have GP permission. And that is for safety for me, but particularly for the person you're training. Because if anything happens to them, well, you could be in court. Certainly this island is very litigious. You could certainly be in court. But you don't want the knowledge that you could have prevented something going wrong if you'd only been a bit more careful. You don't want that. So you have to be mindful of safety. Number one, make it a rule. I don't train anyone unless I have the GP having checked their blood pressure and saying, yes, it's okay. And they can go ahead. And you keep an eye if you tell them if they want, it's between the person and the GP. So the GP and the person are linked. I don't contact the GP. The person's going to do the training with me contacts the GP. That's where the link is. And that's important to keep that relationship going because they're the ones, the person with the problem medically needs to be the one who can contact the GP very quickly. So I want you to really take that message home. Okay, Jade, that's the next slide, please. Okay, so basically, the very basics of AT, where are we going? So how does it help with pain? Obviously, the relaxation response reduces pain, the sense of pain. It's the sense of stress and helps to reduce pain perception. You see, reduces anxiety. And that's the critical thing is that we can see things more as a challenge rather than a threat. Rather than saying, ah, oh, it's too much for me, I'm going to give up, I'm going to do what I'm, I can cope with this. I can do this. With somewhat I know this I have to do, I can do it. So how stressor is perceived is key aspect of stress management. And pain is a stressor. So we put pain into that category as a stressor, how it's perceived and its intensity. Now, I'm in a lucky place, but you need that. I am really in a lucky place. I know how to manage pain from both a medical perspective and a psychological perspective. I give patients 100% credit if they don't have any kind of pain management knowledge and they manage it because I think it's so complicated and it's so individualized. You know what works for you. Personally, I know what works for me. I know how to keep my pain under control, but it's not something I would hand over to my neighbor, I can tell you. I wouldn't. It is complicated. It's complex. You have to know your medications. You have to know what works when. You have to know what works alongside your medications to be able to keep that pain intensity level down. And to know, okay, I'm only experiencing faint pain, to a pain. You don't want it to go above a 4 or 5. You just don't want it because that's when the blood pressure starts to go. So it's not easy. This is something, a skill that comes with time and experience in doing the work. It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of experience. That's why we have people doing courses. That's why we now have pain clinics. That's why we now in Ireland, we were the first to make pain a specialty in its own right alongside the anesthesiologist. So we've done this wonderful work in the 1970s, well, 50s onwards, but from the 70s for IAS. But we know how difficult this whole problem is, and to give the power to the person with the pain requires huge resources of patient education, patient support, and listening to the patient. A biopsychosocial model, because everyone's need is different. I know you're going to go away from here today and say, oh my gosh, this is a challenge. It is a challenge. You'll see books called The Challenge of Pain. But it's not something we can't do. We can do it. It's just we have to have individualized medicine to do it really effectively. We have to know our stuff. We have to keep on top of our game. We have to keep informed. We have to keep learning. And we have to keep practicing. That's what I'm always doing. I'm always doing my CPD. I'm always attending programs, courses, whatever, so that the skill doesn't go. And even if you're like me at the moment, out of action, decommissioned for a year, I can still learn. I can still do my CPD online. I can still keep up with the knowledge part of things and attend things online. So it's not a quick ride. It's not something you get there fast with. Okay, next slide, Jane. Jane, please. Okay. So it's how do we interpret things? Well, again, we've talked about what's going on in someone's life. Strong or negative emotions, activation of the structures that are there in our brain for registering these events. The limbic center in the old brain needs to, it then expresses our emotion. It activates those mechanisms that make us know something is wrong, the stress response. How do we respond? Because what is critical to us is, okay, you're sitting there saying, but there's nothing there to worry about. And I'm saying, ah, I'm frantic about this. Stressors are in the eye of the beholder. What is worrisome to you, with respect, may not be worrisome to me. It's all subjective. It's how we see things, what information we have, and what our past experience is. And that's why we have to respect what the other person is saying and listen to them, because we're not in a position to make a judgment. That's why we call it patient-centered medicine. And it's not easy. For some people, it's extremely difficult to make that transition. It's change, because medics for a long time have had control. They're the ones who tell people what to do, and now suddenly the whole thing is different. People are coming in and saying, this is me, listen to me, give me this service. Gosh, who do you think you are? I'm the patient. We call this patient-centered care. And it is a human right. Okay, next slide, please. Go ahead.
Sheila,
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say, but I'm not hearing quite a lot of what you're saying. You're dropping your voice quite a bit, and there's an awful lot which is being missed. So it would be lovely if you could stick to the slides and really discuss each point.
Right. Okay, Jane. Thank you.
Because
Thank you.
otherwise, we are missing a lot of what you're beautifully prepared. Yeah.
Okay. So, okay. So, did you get most of this one? You're
Well,
dropping out a lot.
it's dropping out, isn't it? Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
I think what you're doing is talking around the slides so much that we're, and then we miss what you've actually said. And when I can't do the reading at the same time as try and work it out.
Okay.
So a lot of this, we do know about the challenges that people meet in their autogenics, and it's for us to reframe, isn't it, and to
Absolutely,
make things
absolutely.
happen.
Yes.
Yes. So sorry, I'll put myself on mute again. Okay.
Okay, that's fine. How are we doing, Jade? How many small slides are there? Okay.
Sheila Jo's just counting them actually, because
They're fine.
it
Okay.
doesn't
Yeah,
say
I
we're
was
on
just looking
number
at the time
one
here.
of.
Yeah, I could see how much time left, Donna. I see.
16.
Oh, there's 16 slides left.
Right, I gallop through these now. Okay, so you know a lot of this already. AT originated at the beginning of the 20th century because, again, it was a very strong time of hypnosis by Schultz. That's the person who twigged that, in fact, what could happen was this change from doing something to the person, which is what the hypnotists were doing. And Schultz said, no, we could actually give people a technique they can do for themselves. And he handed this technique, autogenic training, to the person. Considered to have interactive psychophysiological slide, mechanisms promoting deep relaxation, as we know, and system-wide homeostatic regulation. And that's exactly what we know about that. And it enables us, through passive concentration, to revert from this arousal associated with stress, sympathetic activity, to a calmness state. And it's exactly designed for that purpose, to reinforce the organism's tendency for balance, homeostasis. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. And so we know I don't actually have a brainwave chart here. And again, I want to recommend a book to you by Mihasadi about chronic pain. There are three editions of it. Mihasadi did some really good lectures for us a couple of years back during COVID, and he looked into the different brainwaves associated with autogenic training. And it's really, really different from sleep or hypnosis. So there's a lot of, instead of alpha, there's more like delta and theta brainwaves. And it also supports Schultz's original concept of a specific process, so that it's in its own department, if you like. It's its own state, different from the normal conscious control that we have. Okay, that's that one. Let's just like these. So then, autogenic training and related autogenic approaches are designed to promote and support brain-directed self-regulatory, i.e., autogenic mechanisms, which normally participate in homeostatic, recuperative, and self-normalizing processes. And these effects of autogenic training, these physiological and psychophysiological effects, may be considered as diametrically opposed to the changes brought about by stress. So Naglatzi commented that AT may have positive effect on tension headache, mild to moderate hypertension, coronary artery disease, heart disease, asthma, pain disorder, Raynaud's disease, anxiety, mild to moderate depression, and functional sleep disorders. And we have a shortage of really good substantial studies on effect studies of if AT and pain. Very difficult to set up studies on pain, but we hope in the future that it will happen. Because now that AT is moving into the pain clinic scenario in hospital settings where they are now open to different alongside not just medical interventions, but also things that people can take on board for themselves and put them back in control. It's not about having an injection. It's not about taking the tablet on time. It's about what can I do for myself. It's not alternative therapies. It's complementary and alternative to go alongside medical treatments. So that is what this whole point about autogenic training in the pain setting, alongside a choice of different types of CAM, so that people can choose what they find suits them. And we're all different, so not everyone wants to do AT. It's what works for the person. Okay, next slide, please. So fibromyalgia syndrome, I'd like to have spent much more time on this, and I think this is an important one for another day for you, if you were interested or had time to do this, because this is such a very prevalent syndrome in the community, particularly the country with Ireland. It's recognized now. It's the symptoms of fibromyalgia. It's like a whole problem across the whole muscular system, but it right across the body, and it causes huge reduction in quality of life. So it's a state of pain that is throughout the person. They feel it throughout themselves. They're very tired. They do have memory problems. They have sleep and mood problems. And neurotransmitters are being found. I don't know if any of you subscribe to the inputs from websites like neuroscience.com, where they send you updates and they tell you the latest research findings for various things. Well, more and more they're finding now that various cells that are linked to kind of normal, as we thought, hormone production here, or certain different types of hormones that we need, and different products that we need at nerve endings, can transition under pain states to produce a toxic combination that exaggerates the pain state. So nerve endings and their cells can mutate into a different function. And certain neurotransmitters can be very, very toxic. So it's now classified as a rheumatic disorder. And you can imagine, if you're living in a country like Ireland, where we've just experienced in March the wettest March on record, and I think we had the wettest June or July on record, or the hottest July and the wettest June as well. So we've had a lot of rain this year. And if you have that combination, especially people living in the west of Ireland, before we had the development we've had in recent years, where housing was of very low quality, heating was of virtually non-existent, people were living in cottages which were unheated, no thermal lining of any kind, and managing on subsistence, where they're exposed to the elements a lot, then these syndromes set up so easily. So people in the west of Ireland particularly would have had a huge level of rheumatic disorders right throughout all different systems in their body. And you'll find that with people who have been exposed to the weather, or there's a genetic, now again, genetic as in everything, handed on to somebody who experienced it, component to that as well. So the criteria have now changed, and it can occur at any age. So people have to be careful to make sure that their lifestyle doesn't facilitate the onset of something like this. And that's where things like clothing and heating and good housing, and making sure not to go out in cold, windy conditions and get chilled off on a regular basis. Okay, so it's about prevention as well. Okay, next slide, please, Jade. So now what we've had in recent years, again, COVID disrupted this, but it's gradually coming into different countries. We now believe people when they have pain. So again, fibromyalgia syndrome treatment was the lack of recognition of chronic pain as a disease. If you don't have chronic pain recognized, people making it up or imagining it, then there's no code to purchase the treatment. So the codes have to be there in the health system, in the departments of finance, to allow the treatment to go ahead, because the hospitals have to apply for treatment with those codes. And to have pain, when they're giving the treatment, they apply using those codes to be paid for the treatment they're given. So if those codes exist, then the funding is there from the budgets. It's allocated to certain diseases. That's why everything has to have a code. Now we have codes for certain chronic pain syndromes. And that means it's recognized. So it can be given treatment and people can have that treatment with the funding that's there in government funding. So fibromyalgia syndrome is classified as chronic primary pain. That's a major step forward in being able to provide a service for people with chronic pain. Next step, the next slide, please, Jade. Okay, so again, we look at this, integrated care. The second line, fibromyalgia syndrome, best treated by integrating pharmaco and non-pharmacological approaches. If you take any message home today, that is the one line to take home. It causes so many problems, this change, because it's so difficult to get people to change their mindset sometimes, to recognize that non-pharmacological approaches are valid and important for people to manage their life, to help them cope, to help them feel in control, to help them feel well, to restore their energy, to restore their purpose. Psychological, behavioral, and social issues contribute to the pathogenesis of FMS and complicate its treatment if people are constantly barraged with negative influences. They're more likely to have depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, PTSD, because they've been exposed to very difficult situations. Again, being able to have these treatments, being able to access them, find what works for them. They have to find that because we can't tell them what works. How does it help them reduce their stress? How does it improve sleep? How does it improve activity, exercise, and at the pace they can manage? Again, exercise is really important, but an appropriate exercise, obviously, very appropriate. And again, that's increasingly recognized. Very, very important to keep active. And that hugely depends on where we live. Massively depends on where we live and the culture of where we live. Does it allow someone to get out there with their dumbbells and do their exercises? Or does it allow them to do their 10K walk? Or does it allow them or not? Because there's so many places where say, get in your chair and do nothing. Now that's changing again because people are living longer. It's a circular impact. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. Dysregulation of FMS. So 8 is hugely helpful for somebody with fibromyalgia syndrome. Adjustment of the nervous system through mechanisms of, and that I'm sure everyone who does AT knows about that and experiences it personally because it is so very helpful. Irritable bowel syndrome can be very, very helpful for people with irritable bowel syndrome to actually reduce or even stop the symptoms and potentially for significantly improved pain and social functioning. And that's not just for irritable bowel syndrome and not just for FMS, but across the board in everything for chronic pain. again, depends on the person, depends on what they, how they find it. I found over the years doing with people with cancer and with people with pain of non-malignant origin, if you have a group of people, say 6 to 8 people in any one group doing AT, you'll find that maybe 2 or 3 do really, really well. Another 2 or 3 do, oh, okay, it's fine, it's lovely. And maybe one says, okay, I'm doing okay, but, you know, I like such and such better. So it's making a difference out there. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so FMS now has evidence-based guidelines. Okay, they're specific. What do we do? How do we do it? And what things are required? What are the things that are required to make sure that the treatment meets the standard that is recommended? Okay, so again, if you've got people contributing to these guidelines, to offering good research that shows that AT worked for this particular group of people, then that's invaluable for it, for promoting AT in that context as well. So we had a study there in 2016, a randomized controlled trial of 566 patients. And that's, if they can do that, it's wonderful. An advanced multidisciplinary self-management patient education program of patients with fibromyalgia syndrome. And it included AT as part of one intervention condition. It was a strong focus on transfer to everyday life. So all those things, and again, it just says that, just to comment on that, it's AT as part of one intervention condition, because recognizing that AT isn't going to be something that everyone's going to opt for. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so, okay, well, I think we can just, this is kind of complicated. We're getting into a different region here of FMS and chronic regional pain syndrome. That is really advanced pain problems. You will have met, possibly, if you have been working in chronic pain, people with very reddened skin on their arms and or legs. And they would have a lot of pain in their limbs. And that's where there has been changes, what we call centrally, in within the brain and the whole nervous system, that has impacted the whole nervous system and how it functions. And it comes right down to skin level. And that is why it is so vital to control pain early, because that's the far end of extreme of what can happen when pain goes out of control. The whole nervous system becomes, we had this terrible term for yonks called wind up, and people used to ridicule it. They used to think it was terribly funny to have that wind up term in pain. But in fact, what it meant was that the whole system became like a car, way out of control speed-wise. And that's exactly what can happen if pain is not, if pain is chronic and constantly not controlled, it's constantly ongoing at a severe level, the system just goes out of control. It's like a car going at 200 miles an hour constantly. And it can induce changes both in the brain, in the central nervous system, and those changes go right down to the skin level. And those people who have those syndromes of chronic regional pain syndrome, they suffer very much. They suffer very much. So it's up to services, it's up to people like us to make sure that the services we offer make sure people don't get to that state. It should never happen. It's preventable. It's preventable because we need to listen to people. We need to have the treatments in place to make sure those situations don't arise. We need to have the pain clinicians there. We need to have the services there. Okay, folks, next slide, please, Jade. Okay, I think, again, I've kind of covered that, because you can read that for yourself. And then the next slide, Jade, because I think we need to bring this to conclusion. This time is up now. Okay, and next one. I've kind of really done a lot on this before, because it's such an important topic in chronic pain. And I know, Jade, it'll be on the website for people, I presume, or you can send this PowerPoint to everyone in your program. They're very welcome to have this PowerPoint. And the information is there because you can see just again, it's important to keep up to date with the literature, what's happening in terms of neurology, what's happening in terms of looking at the neurobiology, because all the time research is showing us, particularly with high tech, what is happening centrally, the changes that are going on in the brain and the various spinal cord areas, particularly in the fiber, the nerve fibers, and how those different substances that are produced in the nervous system undergo change. And those changes impact on what happens to the person's whole system. Neuropeptides can be so, so toxic. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so that's some reading list for you, and you will enjoy that. Because again, if you have time, use Google Scholar. If you don't have access to an academic inventory, use Google Scholar. A lot of this stuff will be on Google Scholar. If you want something particular, if you find a paper you'd like to read, particularly, you can contact myself through Donna or Jade or Jane, and I will do my best to get it for you. But please do look at the website for IAS, and do look at the website for Chronic Pain Ireland, particularly look at the videos on Chronic Pain Ireland. They're little videos lasting about 20 minutes, looking at different topics, and they are invaluable regarding pain education for people. If you're working, as you are, with people with pain, they're absolutely invaluable, giving an insight into what patients experience and how we can be more empathic in tune with that and make our AT more relevant, our AT approach more relevant, so that people can get more out of it for their coping for their situation. And I really appreciate your patience. I'm sorry that things went wrong tech-wise. I didn't know for sure whether I had a problem. Now I know I do have a problem, but I get that sorted as soon as I can with my high-tech people. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheila. I look forward to receiving that PowerPoint presentation. There's an enormous amount of information there, and that's going to be wonderful, wonderful background kind of knowledge that we probably haven't got in anything like that detail.
You're very Thank welcome, you. Jane. Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank
okay.
you, Sheila.
So you finished with me today then, probably, are you?
Yes. I mean, unless anybody has any questions.
I think you probably all need a cup of coffee at this stage, do you?
Well, we certainly do. Yes, that is perfectly true. Yes.
And thank you, Jane. I really, Jane, Donna, and Jade, you've been all lovely and kind to me. And I needed that. And, you know, it's in what's happened to me is a boost to my own confidence, kind of put me back on my feet a little bit again, more and more. And so thank you for that. And I'm sorry we had the tech problems. And if I can do anything else in the future, let me know, okay?
Thank you, Sheila.
Yes, thank you very much, Sheila. That's brilliant. We will remember.